for SearchSecurity.com. I'm Bill Brenner.
And I'm Rob Westervelt.
You're listening to a special edition of Security Wire Weekly for January 3rd, 2008.
This edition, we'll listen to what I consider my top five interviews this year, including segments on radio frequency identification, secure software development, web services, SOA security, and full disk encryption, and some interviews I conducted for our sister podcast, Security 360. This is in no particular order. The first interview that I selected for this podcast was with Adam Laurie. Adam Laurie is big in RFID, radio frequency identification technology. Right now, he's chief security officer and director of The Bunker. It's called The Bunker Secure Hosting, and it's based in the UK. But really, his focus has been on radio frequency identification security. He has researched this to no end. And what he has done is he's been able to show how you can easily replicate an RFID card without all of the wires. I mean, it looks like a real card that he produces. And he's been able to do this with European passports that have RFID technology in it. He's just a really interesting guy to speak to.
Now, this caused quite a bit of controversy.
It did at the time, and he's been speaking on it ever since. And the strangest thing is he hasn't really gotten much of a response from the RFID chip makers and the RFID vendors. Whenever he can, he will definitely try to get them to take some action and produce more secure products. His whole point is that these guys need to come up with, if they're going to be in this business, they need to come up with a product that is secure. And I met up with Adam at the Black Hat conference in August.
Mm-hmm.
What has been the response from vendors from your research?
The guys who actually make the readers are not very happy that I'm illustrating faults with their beloved RFID. So that's not been very positive. I haven't actually had any specific lock manufacturers or RFID system vendors come back and discuss things with me. There's been various toing and froing with the Home Office about the passports. We don't seem to talk to each other directly. We do it through the newspapers. But, you know, they come back with it's not that bad because blah, and then I go and prove that blah is actually not true. The only country I've seen that actually shields the passport is the U.S., so it's built into your passport cover. If it's fully closed, then it's shielded. But as we've demonstrated, if it's very slightly open, and I mean only as open as it would be if you dropped it on the table and let it naturally spring open, millimeters, it actually seems to enhance the signal. So it makes it better for a reader that's going from a remote distance.
In general, how far away would you have to be to be able to pick that up?
The furthest I've heard of an RFID tag being read from was 69 feet, and that was done by Flexilis a couple of years ago at DEFCON 12, actually, on the roof of the Alexis Park. But they had a really big antenna, and they were aiming it, you know, directly at the tag. So that's a very theoretical scenario. You never get that in real life. But you don't necessarily have to be far away. I mean, I can stick a couple of gates on a doorway and everyone who walks between those gates is going to get read. So I'll get the keys out of their pocket as they walk through. Or I wire wrap the doorway so the whole entire doorway becomes an antenna. You cannot get through it without walking through my antenna. So, distance isn't necessarily the object.
Let's talk about what you demonstrated. You cloned a tag. It's the first clone that is completely identical.
Basically, as I tried to explain in the talk, the technology is designed to do this. All I've done is expose the fact that a standard tag, like a Q5, can emulate another tag, like an EM4102.
Without a giant circuitry board of some kind.
Correct. So, yeah, without having to build any circuits or have, you know, funny-looking devices, you've actually produced a door tag that looks exactly like the original and has the same ID as the original. But that's what that tag was designed for. So all I've done is kind of, you know, work my way through the industry lies and come to the end and said, well, hang on a minute. You know, you're producing devices that are designed to make it possible for a vendor to set the ID to any number he wants and sell it to a customer, but you're telling the customer that that ID is cast in stone and could never be duplicated. And those two statements are completely incompatible. And I've just, you know, gone beyond the theory to the practical and written the software that demonstrates that and published it. That software is commercially available and installed in thousands of RFID chip supplier chains all over the world. So, you know, within the industry, everyone knows this.
And with that, the next interview that I selected is with Brian Chest and Jacob West. You know these guys, Bill?
I do.
They're with Fortify Software, and they are both involved with secure software development. They're both involved with secure programming and penetration testing. And I had a chance to, I thought it was going to be an interview with Brian Chess himself, but it was an interview with both of them about their latest book, Secure Programming with Static Analysis. But we really got to talking about the entire penetration testing business and how it has emerged and it has evolved.
Ajax technology, basically combining JavaScript and a web browser and maybe some XML, is really not new. People have been doing it for probably about 10 years now. What's new is it's gotten popular. And it does change things, but it doesn't necessarily change things in the way people think about it. The major threats that they had last year, like cross-site scripting, still exist today. So what has changed? Well, first of all, the bad guys have started buying JavaScript books too. So things that people used to be manipulating in order to mash up two websites, bad guys have now figured out that they can use to steal data out of your web application, whether it's a Ajax application or not. They can use Ajax techniques in order to steal data out of it.
Why is it so difficult then to secure Ajax?
So a lot of the techniques that people have been using to test traditional web applications don't work so well when it comes to Ajax applications. So it no longer looks like a really simple client-server model, and now starts to look a little bit more like a thick client model. And so now we're back having to solve the software testing problem that people have been trying to solve for literally decades. And that's not easy, and it's certainly not easy to automate. So in one sense, what Ajax applications have done is made it harder for the good guys to verify that they've got secure code.
Jacob, what are some techniques then that can be used to guard against some of these Ajax threats?
Well, so a lot of the problems really end up manifesting themselves the same way the vulnerabilities always have in the web applications. This is just another source of input, another way of interacting, and encourages more dynamic behavior, as Brian was saying, more like a thick client would in the past.
What should programmers be doing that they're not doing right now?
Well, so I think a big onus is on people like us, tool manufacturers, to give them better mechanisms for finding the problems. So traditional pen testing, for example, has a real problem interacting with Ajax applications in some cases because the client is so much more dynamic. So you're doing more data processing on the client. The sort of traditional record and replay techniques don't work as well, because you're the traffic moving back and forth between the client and the server looks quite different from one moment to the next because you're doing more processing on the client.
Mm-hmm. Brian, what's lacking in traditional pen testing that causes it to miss so many vulnerabilities?
Traditionally speaking, penetration testing has been a little bit like shooting fish in a barrel. Right. So there are so many things wrong with the code that if all you want to do is try and prove that there's a problem, that's pretty easy. The sort of dangerous trend that we see these days is people maybe trying to rely on that penetration test to sort of bake security into the software after the fact. And that just simply isn't going to work any more than trying to bake quality into the code after the fact. It doesn't work. So, what we're really all about at Fortify is trying to help people integrate security into their software development process. Whether that's as part of writing the code or whether it's part of their typical testing activities that they conduct before they call that product finished.
Jacob, can you get better results out of maybe doing testing manually?
Particularly with respect to Ajax, you mean? Yeah, so some of the same limitations that the automated tools face with Ajax, a manual test wouldn't necessarily, because you're interacting with the application as it's intended to be interacted with, so through the interface, as opposed to trying to kind of bypass that and do a replay of traffic that you've seen. At the same time, it can add complexities for manual testing, too, mostly because of the nature of the applications, more so than the specific technical impact. So they tend to have richer client-side interfaces, more dynamic content, so there may be it may be more difficult to exercise the entire interface of the application manually, just because there's more to be seen on the client side.
So that was Brian Chess and Jacob West. Really interesting conversation we had at the Black Hat Conference in August. Next, I'm going to take you to the Burton Catalyst Conference that took place in June in San Francisco. We talked about web services and SOA security with Chris Haddad, who is Director of Technical Architecture at the Burton Group. And he helped me understand the entire SOA and web services world here and where security factors in. He laid out some of the serious threats facing web services. He talked about service-oriented architecture development. And really right now, if you want to talk about some of the security issues, it's right around standards development. It's such an early stage for SOA. I know they've been talking about it for probably the past 5 years now, but it's still in the early stages where they're trying to develop better, more secure standards around SOA and web services.
You mentioned WS security. Are companies beginning to deploy WS security?
Companies are just now adopting WS security as a mainstream way of doing business. It's been very difficult for organizations to adopt WS security in the past because the tooling to implement the specification has been fairly immature. You had to be a rocket scientist to connect up a .NET service client with a J2E service in using the specification. The introduction of web service security products such as XML gateways and XML VPNs has enabled teams to implement this specification in a more easy manner.
Can you explain what is SSL and WS security, and are they good enough protocols for securing message traffic?
SSL stands for Secure Socket Layer, and it's a way to encrypt message traffic between a client and a service. The encryption happens at the network layer, and it's only good between a particular client and a particular server. And so it builds a very tight connection between the two. If the message is then taken off the wire or routed to another service provider, the security context disappears. Protocols such as WS security enable the security context to span across multiple intermediaries who can inspect the message and who might be routing and passing the message along. And that's where providing a level above the network enables you to keep the encryption in place even when the message is taken off of the wire.
So do companies have a choice between using WS security or SSL, or can they use a combination of both?
A best practice is to use a combination of both.
And with that, let's move on to industry consolidation. This is a segment that I took from our sister podcast, Security 360. I had a really good interview with Andy Jones. I met up with him at the InfoSec World 2007 conference in Orlando. I decided to put together a 360 around industry consolidation because this you can really make a case that 2007 was a year where we really saw a lot of high-profile mergers.
Absolutely. And in a lot of cases,
big IT infrastructure providers acquiring security companies to bake that security into their larger offerings.
Mm-hmm.
Definitely one of the big trends of this. Microsoft buying up, boy, take your pick. You know, HP this year acquiring Spy Dynamics.
Mm-hmm.
And again this year, IBM acquiring WatchFire.
I think IBM acquiring WatchFire came first, and then HP followed up maybe a week later with
Yeah, Spy Dynamics. I do remember I was at the Gartner Security Conference in D.C. the first week of June, and my last day there was when we got word about IBM acquiring WatchFire.
So with all of these different acquisitions going on, and you could see it's really difficult to keep track of it all. There is a really good report out, by the way, by the Burton Group. Came out sometime this summer. I'll have to get the name of that report. But it really summed up the whole acquisition landscape quite nicely over the past several years. It even had a nice chart of what was going on with the different acquisitions and what the strategy was behind all of the acquisitions. What really came up in my mind was, how do companies respond? Just the average Joe Schmo company, how does it respond to an environment of increased industry consolidation? And how does it develop an effective security strategy? And that's why I thought Andy was great here. He really showed how a company can actually develop an effective strategy to deal with all of that.
The presentation you gave, or at least one of the presentations that you gave here at the conference, was about creating a successful information security strategy.
Yeah.
It seems really, really broad to me. Mm-hmm. Maybe you can define that for us. What does that mean to you? And
yeah, it's a pretty broad subject. It's not something there's a lot of maturity around. We talked to a number of our members. About 25% of our members seem to have some sort of security strategy. To some people, that's just a plan, but we're seeing a number of drivers that are forcing you to have one, particularly around compliance and audit. So people are starting to wake up to the fact that they actually need to have one. Now, it is quite a broad thing. Strategy in itself is quite a loosely defined subject. So people are really struggling to actually say, well, what does that actually mean for information security? We've taken the approach, we've done quite a lot of work now, and we're taking the approach that there are three aspects of the strategy.
Okay.
One is that we demonstrate the information security actually adds to the business strategy and maps directly to the business strategy and the business initiatives and supports and add value. So that's one aspect of it, and there are various techniques we've looked at to actually do that. The second aspect, which is perhaps more the information security comfort zone, is defending against threats.
Mm-hmm.
And actually knowing that our strategy needs to be long-term protection against threats, and that means threats that we don't currently know about. So you need to actually take a look at what's coming down the pipeline.
Be proactive instead of defensive.
Yeah, very proactive risk mitigation, really. There's an area of crystal ball gazing about it, but to some extent you've got to do that. The third aspect, which is actually really a positioning aspect, saying where is the information function? Do we have a seat at the top table?
Finally, the last interview that I selected was an interview I did back in March at the InfoSec World 2007 conference in Orlando. I met up with Roger Hurst. He is really deep into full disk encryption. And you could really say that with the payment card industry data security standards, with data breaches, lost laptops in the news in 2007, companies are really taking a closer look at full disk encryption, or at least taking a look at encrypting some laptops in the some high profile laptops. And Roger actually was involved in a major project at the Timken company where he works as a senior IT specialist. He led the deployment of full disk encryption on about 5,000 employee laptops.
I'm with the Timken Company. We manufacture bearings and specialty steels operations worldwide.
Why endpoint encryption? Is that an area that you've been associated with?
Well, I have been associated with it for a long time. I was one of the earliest users of PGP for file encryption. And in fact, I worked in conjunction with Phil Dunkenberger when they purchased PGP back away from Network Associates and basically doing analysis of the product. The endpoint security encryption side is basically, especially like hard drive encryption, if your laptop leaves your company, you know, our policy says it has to be encrypted, and we do full hard drive encryption because we don't want our intellectual property walking away along with a laptop that might be lost or stolen. Same would be true for PDA or any other device as well, but of course, you know, most of the focus is on the laptop side. So that's the main reason we want to do the endpoint encryption from a hard drive perspective. The way we said is if a laptop leaves our facilities, period, it has to have the hard drive encrypted. That's it. I mean, don't worry about who owns it. Don't worry about who controls it. If the laptop walks out the door ever, it has to have its hard drive encrypted. Now, we do have a few laptops that are in-house that never leave the premises, mostly in our manufacturing operations. We don't require those hard drives to be encrypted because, again, they're within our facility. But if it leaves the facility ever, it has to have that hard drive encrypted. And that made it easy. That way we don't have to guess as to, well, are this certain level of people, should we do this? This might have secure data on it, it might not. You don't need to worry about that. We just say, we're doing it universally. Everybody has to do it, all laptops worldwide. And that made it a little easier to deploy. As far as the criteria is concerned, one of the major issues that I looked at was obviously robust encryption that can't be easily hacked. That's certainly, that goes without saying. But some of the products out there maybe aren't as strong in that area as others. Most of the really well-known products are first rate. So you don't have to worry about the encryption. It's secure.
And that'll do it for this week. Remember, the latest security news is always available as it breaks on our news page at searchsecurity.com/news. You can also catch all of our podcasts by going to searchsecurity.com/podcast. Again, I'm Bill Brenner.
And I'm Rob Westervelt.
Have a great week.
Happy New Year, folks.